Happy Friday and welcome back to the Compass live stream, the only live stream about proof of work mining and therefore the best live stream about proof of work mining. We're glad you're watching. And as always, special thanks to my co-host, Will. Glad to be back with you for another stream. Will, thanks for being here.
Totally, really excited for today's stream. You and I have talked about finances for miners, whether it be public firms or private miners trying to bootstrap things in their garage. It's a very underexplored topic. So really excited to have these two on to kind of give us the lowdown on that side of the industry.
Yeah, we talk a lot about hardware and geopolitics and supply chains on past streams. And now we're digging into the finance side of mining, which will be fun. And as a warning, anyone who says finance on this stream will get kicked off. But I'm excited for the conversation we're about to have. Before our guests introduce themselves, if you're watching, make sure to hit the like and the subscribe buttons. That helps other miners find this content and it makes us feel good about ourselves. To anyone listening on the podcast later, we're glad you're listening. Love you guys. But I promise the video version is better. And with that, I want to turn it over to our guests, Roshan and Brian. Can you guys just give us a quick summary of your backgrounds, how you got into the Bitcoin and the mining industry, and high level overview of what you guys are working on now? Brian, if you don't mind starting, and then Roshan.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. So I can start sort of when I got into the Bitcoin space. I honestly got into the space, I think, somewhat serendipitously. Back in 2017, I was working at Fidelity in their internal consulting group. And if you're sort of familiar with kind of a management consulting style staffing project, you're kind of at the whims a little bit of staffing managers, what you're sort of put on at the time. 2017, it was a pretty fun time to be working in the crypto space broadly, like even outside of Bitcoin, kind of ICO boom. And I just kind of happened to be placed on a project that was examining Fidelity's sort of firm-wide crypto strategy, looking at a bunch of use cases. So I was working with a really talented team at the time as well that I got to learn a lot from. So I was working on that project and I mean, never looked back from there, went down the rabbit hole, stayed in Fidelity's consulting group for a while, worked on some of the early stages of some of Fidelity's investment products. So like Fidelity has, you know, passive Bitcoin products today, worked on some of the early stages of that, moved to a different group in Fidelity, Fidelity Center of Applied Technology, where I was part of their blockchain incubator for a bit. It was an awesome group. I had a ton of flexibility to kind of work on what I felt was interesting. At that point, I'd kind of focused more on Bitcoin. I wasn't mining full time sort of at that point, but spending a lot of my time researching the space. I was looking at things like hash rate derivatives. Maybe we'll end up talking about that later. And just working with a bunch of really smart people and people that I liked working with at Fidelity. So people like Amanda, who's current boss, head of mining at Galaxy. And ultimately actually transitioned to the mining team. It was kind of a natural fit for me. It was kind of what I viewed as one of the more exciting things that Fidelity was working on at the space. I thought it was cool that Fidelity had been mining for a long time. So joined the mining team from the blockchain incubator there. Was on the mining team for about a year. Ultimately ended as the director of mining there, leading their operation, and joined Galaxy a couple of months ago. And it's been a really fun start here. I'm now VP of product on Galaxy's mining team. It's really fun to work across a lot of Galaxy's businesses. I work both on sort of our proprietary mining side. So Galaxy has their proprietary mining business. We mine Bitcoin for ourselves. And then we have definitely a large and growing miner finance business as well. So we'll probably dig into a little bit of that. And yeah, that's about it. I guess I'll say one other disclosure as well. Galaxy is an investor in Compass. So while I'm personally a big fan as well, you know, we're a fan for other reasons too.
Love it. Yeah, a lot to unpack there. And we're definitely going to dig into a bunch of those points you mentioned. I think something that stood out to me was that you said you found mining exciting when you were at Fidelity. Almost no one thinks of mining as exciting, except for, you know, people who are in mining, I guess. But yeah, glad to have you in the space. Roshan, can you give us a quick intro and summary of your background and how you got to where you are now?
Yeah, for sure. Brian, that was a great intro. It was awesome to hear. And thanks you guys for having me on the podcast. You know, I kind of got into crypto when I first heard about it in like 2015, kind of when like the Greek referendum was going on, came across Nick Szabo's blog. Bitcoin was, you know, not really something that I took too seriously then, but it was on the back of my mind. Fast forward a year, I was working in trading in Chicago as an intern, as like a prop trader. And, I think it was right after the ETH sort of, DAO kind of got hacked. And the price of ETH went from 20 to 10. I started taking this the space more seriously, looking into it. Ultimately, after I graduated college in 2017, I started working as a trader in Chicago, like an algorithmic trader. And, you know, as that sort of market got really wild in like 17, 18, I was spending more time doing like crypto outside of work rather than my actual job. So I kind of made the switch full time to kind of go trade ARB on my own inventory for a while. And, you know, it was kind of going well, but the issue was like, there wasn't really a liquid derivatives marketplace for Bitcoin and Litecoin. I mean, Bitcoin had some stuff, but Litecoin and some of the other assets that I was cross ARBing didn't really have places to hedge. So like effectively you had to take a lot of delta risk as you scaled up your strategies. And then coming into like March of 2018, I basically like, you know, realized that like, yeah, like, you know, you made more units of these things, but like in terms of dollars, you were actually like not up nearly as much as you thought. In fact, like in some senses down. So I started like, you know, stepping back from just doing that. And I Googled kind of how to borrow Litecoin, and I came across Genesis Trading, and Genesis, you know, kind of launched a lending desk sitting adjunct to their trading desk back in 2018 that had just started. There was like a Business Insider article about like, you know, it was like 2 weeks into it and they had 100 million loans outstanding. I'm like, okay, this seems interesting. And I joined there as kind of like the first hire on that desk as an analyst. And yeah, I've been there since, you know, 3.5 years, same firm, same desk, analyst associate, now VP of lending. And my day-to-day focus is, I think, a little bit less probably on the mining side relative to you guys, more so on the trading and financing side of things, of which mining is like a component of our broad portfolio of loans that we make. And a big reason for that is like, you know, Genesis is wholly owned by Digital Currency Group, which is a big sort of venture capital firm in the space. And in late 2019, early 2020, we started a subsidiary called DCG Foundry, which is now a fairly large mining pool, kind of focusing on bringing hash power to North America. And, you know, we do kind of a lot of transactions and like, you know, talk to Foundry a lot. And that's kind of how we do interface with the miners out there, and as well as directly in some senses too. So that's kind of my background. Been there for 3.5 years. Yeah, excited to be on here.
Yeah, that's awesome. Thank you both for that. And although, you know, Brian works more in the mining day-to-day things side of things than you, Roshan, I wanted both of you on for sure because you both have very unique and insightful perspectives on the entire crypto industry, especially the finance side of things, more generally in some cases, and then more specific to mining in other cases. I think the conversation we're going to have will be very educational. So thank you both again for being on here. I kind of want to start off with like a very general question. I think you all will probably both tackle it from different angles, which I'm sort of interested in hearing both of your opinions. But like, what financial products do miners need the most and or use the most right now in the market as you see it right now? What are the state of miner financial products? What do they use the most and what do they need the most? Brian, probably start with you again, and then Roshan, hand it to you as well.
Sure. Yeah, happy to do that. And I think Roshan probably can talk more articulately than me, even about some of like the lending products and some of the nuances here. And so, and I'll approach it a little bit more from even like a miner strategy, what I'm seeing from sort of miners in the space. And so I'll separate it a little bit, this question. So first off, I think miners obviously understand this is a very capital intensive business. And so, you know, lending desks are probably busy working with miners. And I think miners are taking advantage of both, you know, debt instruments, equity instruments, and ultimately they just want to raise capital, put it to work, buy machines, build out their sites, build infrastructure at basically the cheapest cost of capital that they can get. And I think even before the Chinese mining ban, I think one clear sort of advantage that North American miners had was just the robustness of our capital markets and our access to relatively cheap capital versus what I think is accessible elsewhere in the world. And you sort of are able to see some of the results of that, even in just press releases with sort of, you know, miners with making very large sort of equipment purchases or building out sort of multi-mega 100 megawatt sites. And so that's something that miners have clearly tapped into, or just various types of instruments there. And then I think you also wanting to make sure that they're sort of using then the assets that they do have So Bitcoin, if they're miners, so they have generally a large pool of Bitcoin where they can do, kind of take advantage of things like Bitcoin-backed loans to then get cash, put that cash to work, as well as using their equipment as collateral and taking out loans against that equipment as well. And so that's something that they've taken advantage of. I think something, other instruments that I think they will see sort of growing use of are just varying types of hedging products. And they're definitely being used today. But I think part of it is that the industry is frankly still even, it's maturing rapidly, but I would still call it even a little bit mature. And I think we'll see, you know, continued use and on in growing use of just different types of products that have existed for a long time in sort of legacy markets that other industries sort of know how to use well, that I think miners are just beginning to sort of understand in some cases. So, I mean, I can dive deeper into any of that, but Roshan, curious your opinion too.
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, that you touched on kind of a lot of the things I was going to say anyways, and like, just to kind of, you know, get it maybe a little bit more specific on the financial products. Like, I think the way I think about the way miners, you know, can use things is one on the sort of like the getting the facilities up and running in terms of efficient capital. So that's like the posting the equipment as collateral or the orders and getting cash against it. So you could, you know, get in, you know, early and like, you know, spend money now without having to kind of tie up a lot of capital and illiquid assets and then wait for things to come and things like that. And then the other whole side of the equation is how long do you really want to be your future cash flows as a miner? So like, you know, you can do that, you know, buy a bunch of machines and get, you know, super long future receivables in crypto. But obviously it's like super volatile and your costs are still relatively fixed in terms of electricity. So then that's when you get into options and futures and other sort of derivative instruments that help miners hedge. I would say those are like kind of the two main sort of ways to think about financing and derivatives in mining. And then, you know, there's like maybe some, there's like a third sort of point, which is like more esoteric things that miners could use. Some related to Bitcoin, but others like more for like other networks, less proof of work and whatnot, where, you know, you might need to borrow the actual underlying rather than cash to get started or things like that. So those, you know, keep it focused on proof of work. We can get into that later if you want, but yeah, that's kind of what I think about.
Totally. And thanks again for guys for coming on the stream. Brian, I want to throw a question right back to you. We've seen that a lot of miners get pretty leveraged positions during bull runs. And we had Vincent Fong, who heads procurement for us here at Compass, jump on the stream. And he was telling us that there's a lot of miners who are holding ASICs just to pump up their valuations, right? Because the price of an ASIC has gone up a lot recently. So why not buy some ASICs, hold on your shelf, and increase the valuation of your firm itself as you go into like maybe a funding round or something similar. Is this like an unhealthy level from your point of view? Are you thinking that like they're a little over their heels at the moment?
I wouldn't say necessarily that they're over their heels. I think the thing that we have to keep in mind when thinking about like the leverage that miners have is that, I mean, fortunately right now for miners, they're still just all like ridiculously profitable, right? Like a lot of these miners are printing coin for, you know, less than 10K a coin in some cases. And so I think in a lot of cases, as long as they have a mining operation up and running, I think they, for the most part, would sort of be able to make a lot of like their margin calls against existing sort of loans that they have on their books. I think part of it too is just on the lenders as well to make sure that they are doing the appropriate due diligence, that, you know, they're keeping their like loan to values like in line with like the sort of volatility that can come with the market. And so it's definitely true and like very good insight. I think that there's definitely a lot of miners that have a pretty significant amount of debt that they definitely just want to borrow, put that cash to work. They want to be oftentimes long Bitcoin. They don't want to sell that. But it's not something that I personally view as like structurally like concerning, at least like from my vantage point right now.
Yeah. If I can ask a follow-up on that really quickly, Steve Barber, who works at Upstream Data or founded that company, had a tweet a few weeks ago talking about how a lot of public miners, or maybe even private too, they're over leveraged because of the plays they made in 2019 and 2020, trying to stay afloat, taking out a lot of loans to keep their business operational. And then 2021 came along, obviously a boon for profits, but then they didn't spend those profits correctly to kind of help out their position from 2019 and 2020. Have you gotten any sense of that? And because it's been raised from a few different people I know in the mining industry that there is an unhealthy sector of the mining industry because of 2019 and 2020.
personally, I don't feel like I've necessarily seen or been exposed to something that I would necessarily view as unhealthy. I think one thing that I definitely view in the market in general is that there's certainly miners out there that view their business as like a cash flow US dollar based business, right? Where they're essentially just capturing spread between the price at which they're mining the coin and the price at which they're and then market price. And so that's a great business right now. Like I said, because you can sort of print coin at like $10,000, sell it at whatever it is today, over 40,000, you have sort of a massive spread there. I think those miners in general, I would say, are a little bit less levered. And that being said, like there's definitely another group of miners that want to be as long Bitcoin as they possibly can get. And their objective is basically to never sell Bitcoin. And if that's sort of what your objective is, then you're relying definitely on debt instruments, on sort of loans that can be available to you to sort of cover your operating costs, cover sort of like how you cover scaling, buying more ASICs. And so it is interesting that you point out that I think there are definitely miners out there where they sort of have experienced this period of probably high levels of profitability. And they could have, if they had chosen to do so, sort of pay off loans, sell some of that Bitcoin. And I think in many cases, you're probably right that some of them didn't do that, and they probably chose to instead, you know, get Bitcoin back loans or use that new Bitcoin to, you know, raise cash through just other means and put that cash back to work. And so I think, you know, the reason I feel like it's not unhealthy is because I understand it from sort of, okay, you now have like very high upside. If Bitcoin's price continues to go up, it sort of seems like it's the right move. But I'm not concerned, because even if we see sort of a Bitcoin like crash, like let's say Bitcoin crashes 20% from here, there's really no, I think, structural problem, because even after that 20% crash, there's still sort of massive margins for those miners that I think will be able to then, you know, withstand, you know, several months of mining. They can make all their margin calls. It would take like a very, very substantial crash in my mind to, you know, create sort of like to really severely damage a lot of the miners that are out there.
Yeah, that's a really interesting perspective, because it's definitely kind of healing some of the stuff that I've heard from others. Get to get the other side of the coin, so to speak. Roshan, I want to throw the question to you, but with a little bit of a spin on it. From a lending desk perspective, supposing that you interact with people across the cryptocurrency industry, including miners, when you're looking at like these different segments of the cryptocurrency industry and you're providing loans for them, does one kind of stand out in particular as more healthy or unhealthy? And how does the mining sector kind of fit into that stack of the lending portfolio?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think, you know, when you're looking at a broad picture of like extracting yield in crypto markets from various like kind of participants in it, mining is nice relative to a lot of the other things because it's somewhat diversified in terms of where the risks lie. Like Genesis's main clients in terms of who drives a lot of our revenue on the lending side are generally trading firms and hedge funds. The trading firms, like the top ones, are, you know, direction neutral. They're market making. They're doing a lot of on-chain arbitrage, market making futures versus spot and swaps. And, you know, they have a lot of like, you know, exchange exposure and on-chain exposure to like protocols and things like that, where, you know, that's not necessarily bad, but miners actually have none of that. And, you know, like Brian was saying, a lot of the miners that are out there do view it as a pure sort of CapEx kind of structure, where they're just like, what does it cost to mine and how much can I earn? So from like a diversifying, you know, what you're lending into, like kind of where your risk lie, I think mining is like a great sort of, you know, piece of a portfolio in that sense. Yeah,
that makes a ton of sense. I kind of want to take all of that, like on sort of the side of miners as borrowers, and sort of explore a little bit of the inverse, miners as the lenders themselves. I think like it's more common than people think, miners lending out their coins, especially for mining operations, you know, that like was Brian was alluding to, want to hold as much Bitcoin as they can, put those assets to work by lending them out to a variety of counterparties across the industry. I'm just curious to know both of your perspectives on sort of the state of miners as lenders, what interactions you've had sort of borrowing from miners or observe other people borrowing from miners, sort of the state of miners lending out their coins, trying to earn yield and also, you know, grow their actual Bitcoin stack at the same time. Roshan, just pass it back to you and then Brian also.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think it's definitely, you're right in the sense that that's gotten a lot more popular. And I think, you know, it makes sense from just like a pure markets and like fund flows perspective. If you're a miner you know, you post Bitcoin as collateral at 10, 15K, and you, you know, equipment as well, let's say, and then, you know, you're mining and the price runs up and you've saved a bunch of coins, you might not necessarily need like to borrow more cash against what that portfolio is worth at like the LTV that the lender would require. So you're going to have excess collateral. And when you have excess collateral, there's really two options. You withdraw it back to yourself, or you sell it, or you keep it, but it's so over collateralized that, you know, you, it's worth asking, hey, can I shift this to some to loan and lend it to you guys? And then, you know, you can get interest paid in USD, which will then help with your sort of monthly expenditures, or you can get interest compounded in kind in Bitcoin and kind of just amass your stack, kind of what miners fundamentally like to do anyways. So I think, you know, you've definitely seen a lot more, you know, supply coming out of the mining side. And I think, you know, you're seeing rates materially lower on crypto across the board, Bitcoin, ETH, really everything. Just because there's more supply willing to lend into the market. I do think miners play a big slice of that. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Definitely agree. It's a big and growing slice of that market. Brian, same question to you. I mean, are and what sorts of miners, you know, coming to you and saying, hey, we want to lend out our Bitcoins. Can you help us orchestrate that? Like, and what dynamics are you seeing in that slice of the mining sector?
Yeah, I only have a little bit more to add. I think, again, I've also experienced sort of a group of miners that are risk averse, don't actually want to trust sort of other custodians or others in general, like with their Bitcoin, and actually give up sort of the opportunity to earn additional yield. I would say like that group I find is sometimes some of the smaller miners, often also the private miners. And so when we look at sort of like subsections of the market here that are looking for sort of this opportunity, I think it's definitely a growing space is the public miners in particular, because it's something where now these public miners have institutional investors that are asking them questions, a growing pool of sort of capital that or Bitcoin that they can generate yield on. And increasingly, you know, their investors are going to be asking them, okay, you have this pool of Bitcoin, what are you doing with it? One option is what we already talked about a little bit in entering into something like a Bitcoin-backed loan and putting that to work, or, you know, acting as the lender themselves, putting it into sort of yield products that are available. And I think, yeah, it's something that, you know, a lot of public miners just have to even be accountable about and make sure that they have a good answer, are generating good rates. But other than that, I don't think I have much to add onto Roshan's answer.
Yeah, for sure. No, I think what you mentioned about trust is like the critical element here. I think the perfect contrast is maybe like your Bitfarms versus Hut 8, where, like, you know, Bitfarms has said, I know Ben has publicly said at least a couple times, they're not, you know, super eager to put their coins in the yield generating products just because they haven't found like a setup that they fully trust. But on the other side of that, you know, Hut 8 is very eager to, and they found, I think through Galaxy and maybe a couple others, like great situations there. It just depends, I guess, on the preference of miners, but more and more you're seeing miners like eagerly take advantage of these yield generating products that they can dump their coins into, maintain Bitcoin on their balance, but also earn extra revenue at the end of the day. I kind of want to broaden that question a little bit, though, because I know, especially at Galaxy, maybe also at Genesis, you guys offer advisory services for miners looking, you know, just basically at the landscape of financial products available to them. And without obviously getting into details you can't disclose, like what financial advice are, you know, your average mining operation looking for at this point in the market? Like, obviously, we've had a huge run up in price, market's cooled off a little bit. But we're still seeing huge leaps in hash rate recovery. Like just a general temperature on the mining industry right now, where are miners' minds at financially when they come and use your advisory services? Yeah, I think, Brian, first to you. Yeah.
Yeah, sure. I think that there are a lot of miners right now. And I think some correctly thinking this and some perhaps naively, that they're very insulated from sort of anything that the market can throw at them. The reason being, and I know probably a lot of listeners understand sort of this dynamic with mining economics, but from the viewpoint that they feel that they're low on the cost curve and sort of below 50%. So like below or sort of in the top, the best 50% of the cost curve. So lowest sort of price of electricity there. And so what that basically means, right, is that when, say, Bitcoin's price were to crash, hash rate then, or miners that are higher on the cost curve, more expensive price of electricity, and therefore higher cost of production of Bitcoin, basically would be forced to turn off their machines first, thus decreasing hash rate. And so the miners that stay online, yes, they have sort of decreasing, the price of Bitcoin is sort of hurting their US dollar denominated revenues just due to the lower price, but they sort of get a somewhat offsetting impact with the lower hash rate, higher Bitcoin denominated revenues. And so I think there are a lot of miners that are sort of looking to that and are feeling, okay, we don't need something like various types of hedging products that are out there because we feel like sufficiently insulated that outside of Bitcoin basically going to zero, we think that we'll sort of maintain profitability. And I think that, you know, sure, that's like an okay viewpoint, but I think increasingly what we sort of focus on is even just educating miners that are out there, from sort of small miners that are, you know, maybe new, maybe even just have a few hundred machines, to even some of the large public miners, on types of hedging strategies that really can protect them from these sort of downside, downside price movements that really could adversely impact them. And I think that, yeah, people like miners right now, I mean, there's some miners that are probably a little bit cocky and just think that nothing bad is going to happen, but eventually this will get to become a low margin business again. And I think a lot of sort of like hedging strategies would be more popular, sort of, let's say even like summer of last year, when Bitcoin price was like 10,000, 11,000, and hash rate might've been like even higher than it was today. And then I think we'd be talking a lot more about just sort of generic like hedging products. And I think there, we don't have to like reinvent the wheel. It's even just educating from miners on, okay, like here's what a call is, here's what a put is, because it's even at that like level that sometimes they still have sort of questions about. And so, yeah, I mean, I think education and just helping miners understand, yeah, what's out there and how it can protect them, I think is a big focus of ours.
That's really interesting, especially, you know, kind of, I don't want to frame this as like in a condescending way, but, you know, just sort of explain the basics, I guess, of potential financial strategies is very interesting, that there's the demand for that. Roshan, same question to you. I'm not sure the extent of, you know, the advisory services that you deal with or your team works with, but just like I'm curious to know your general sense of like where miners' minds are at financially at this point in the market. If you have anything to add there.
Yeah, for sure. I think, you know, Brian has much more insight on the advisory side. Just to be, you know, Genesis is not, doesn't really have like an advisory arm or anything, even for like normal spot trading. You know, clients come to us with their ideas and plans, and we kind of help them get it done. We put out market color and, you know, our thoughts and things like that, but it's never like, hey, you know, you should do this, or this is kind of what we recommend. You know, that being said, broadly speaking on miners and kind of what we've seen over the past a few years being in this market, kind of alluding to your point when we were at like 10K or 12K with the higher hash rate, I think after March of last year, 2020, like that, like the really crazy crash in Bitcoin, you know, you kind of rallied off the lows of like 3, 4K to like 7, 8, 10K with a really strong spot bid coming out of, you know, Western exchanges, but, you know, just generally a lot of people buying the underlying, but you didn't see the futures and the swaps trade at a massive premium to the underlying, despite the market 3Xing, which was unusual, because usually when the market turns bullish like that, you see a lot more leverage being taken out in futures and swaps and funding going higher. So the leading thesis was there, like, you know, who's kind of on the offer here in these derivative instruments after this crash that like really don't want to see lower prices again. The leading theory there is that, you know, a lot of miners were hedging on the way up and were protecting their cash flow because of how, you know, one, because, you know, it makes sense there with like a tighter margin business, but also like the recency of such a sort of catastrophic event. Like, you know, it's like if it were to come retrace or whatnot, like, you know, you really got to protect, because when you get down there to those 4K ranges, like you can't really sustain it there. So it's like, you know, you'll see a lot more of that hedging now. And then, or at those levels now, like when we're at like 40K and, you know, mining costs are much lower, you're right, like the miners have a lot more flexibility to like not worry too much about hedging or option strategies or things like that, and they can focus on incremental yield. So, you know, I think the level of, you know, hedging going on right now by miners is probably not as severe as it was historically, and it's, you know, warranted given the margins are wide right now.
Yeah, Brian, that was a really interesting thought earlier, that miners need to be educated on the basics of financial tools often, or at least need to have like a little refresher course, because like these things would make sense for them just from the outside looking in. So kind of want to turn the discussion a little bit towards public valuations and miners going public, though. So this week we saw Genesis just raised $430 million led by Paradigm to expand operations for its mining business. We've also seen a lot of miners go public over this last year, which has been pretty notable. So obviously, large valuations are happening because there's incentive for profit there. But I'm wondering, just looking at this larger market, a lot of people think it might be a bubble caused by all this COVID relief money. What is your guys' take on maybe the mining industry getting too deep in the cash with the VCs, or maybe going to public too early? Brian, can I throw that to you first?
Sure. I think just maybe a couple of quick comments here. I think one, it makes sense that a lot of miners are looking to do this. And it goes back to a comment I think I made earlier on in the stream with just, we have very robust capital markets, and it's a pretty good way to raise capital in a relatively cheap way, is going to public markets. And I think there's sort of now a track record of a lot of companies doing this and succeeding and sort of getting that capital they need to really scale up and grow. I think one thing too that maybe is leading to like some of these valuations is just there's actually not, or there's a lot of institutional investors out there that have sort of made the decision that they want to allocate to, you know, this like crypto space broadly, we'll call it, not even just like specific to Bitcoin. But then there's suddenly sort of, for some of them, a finite number of options for where they can actually sort of like park that capital. And a pretty good one is, you know, just a normal stock that they invest in all the time. And maybe they can't access sort of other vehicles, or they can't access Bitcoin directly. And so mining companies are a pretty good place to put some of that. And so just given that there's sort of like I said, a very finite number of kind of public equities that are even sort of in this space, that can lead to sort of some higher valuations. But again, I think in terms of like how, if you think they're a high or low, it still is very dependent on kind of where you think the Bitcoin market is right now and where you think that that's going to go. Because I mean, they're going to be highly correlated to Bitcoin price. So if you think that we're in a super cycle right now, I mean, Bitcoin, like mining stocks are probably going to follow Bitcoin price.
Totally, Roshan, I'll throw the same question to you. Just kind of following up on what you're saying, Brian, though, like California and I think New Jersey have both publicly admitted to buying mining stocks. So I guess it's a little bit more in vogue or a little safer than it used to be, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And that probably gets to, I honestly don't know the specifics here, so I'm maybe guessing, but it's possible that, you know, it's in their mandate where that's totally fine, but they probably can't invest directly in Bitcoin, but you get that same sort of exposure to an extent in your portfolio.
Yeah. No, I don't have much to add there other than the sense that like, just generally speaking, like you kind of alluded to it with like a lot of the, you know, COVID money that's in the market and just kind of where public markets are, like, you know, you've seen across the board more companies go public, you know, last year or even recently than ever before in across tech and different sectors. And you're seeing a lot more like ETF products being kind of constructed that are trying to give exposure to the blockchain space or, you know, the gaming space and things like that. So as a miner, you know, if you're thinking about raising money and, you know, public markets are close enough and, you know, it's attainable from a reporting and financial angle, it, you know, it makes a lot of sense to do it. And then, you know, if you get picked up by like a very big ETF that has a lot of flows, like that's going to create like some good value for your company too. So I think, you know, and all the other tech sectors that are doing this are thinking probably the same way. So it's like nothing, you know, too specific to miners. It makes sense. And, you know, they're picking a great time to do it.
I kind of want to keep this conversation going on public companies a minute. Great question from Will. And, you know, like both of you said, there's sort of, a lot of attractive reasons for miners to go public now. Access to more capital, efficient markets, companies shifting from, you know, trading on other markets to listing on the NASDAQ and whatnot. We've seen, I don't know, like at least three mining companies list on the NASDAQ this quarter alone. But Brian, you mentioned, and like there is obviously like a general thesis that some, what amount exactly is unclear, but like some of this investor funds flowing to public mining companies are driven by the fact that they're not able in many cases to actually invest in Bitcoin or ETH or other proof of work coins themselves. And obviously, this is like a highly speculative question, but I'm just curious to know your opinions on like when more of these structured products are launched and are available to institutional buyers, what sort of if any, drop off would you expect in demand to invest in mining companies, assuming that they're, you know, serving as like a proxy now to actually get exposure to Bitcoin and crypto generally, you know, by the next halving or maybe even a little beyond that, when we have more of these products available, what sort of drop off, if any, would you expect? Roshan, back to you. And Brian, obviously want to hear your thoughts too.
Yeah. So, I mean, in terms of quantifying specifically how much of like a outflow you might see from mining stocks because like an ETF is created, or I don't know, like another company decides to take the same approach as MicroStrategy or something like that, it's really hard to say. You know, what I will say though, right now, is that there are like fairly decent public products. You know, Galaxy has some, and some Canadian ones, things like that, where you can get fairly close exposure to the underlying, you know, the actual underlying Bitcoin and Ethereum or other proof of work coins. So, you know, the mining might be viewed as like a different sort of way to extract value out of the underlying that's a little bit distance on the correlation from just being one-to-one beta with spot. And that's because they have the capital expenditure structure and they are making money on a day-to-day basis. It's a cash flow positive business. It's not just like the whole balance sheet of the business is in one asset. And now it's like a, you know, sort of levered play on that asset. So I think, you know, if there's more like specific products launched for just the underlying, miners still serve a purpose in a portfolio of exposure because of their uniqueness to not being beta one.
Gotcha. No, yeah, that makes perfect sense. I mean, if anything, over the past year, we've seen mining stocks serve as a very profitable sort of high beta play to the crypto market generally with, you know, Riot, Marathon, Hut 8, Hive, all the Bitfarms just soaring over the past 18 months. But Brian, same question to you. Like, how much, if you had to guess, like, if any of this investor interest in mining companies would sort of subside once like institutional exposure to Bitcoin becomes even easier?
Yeah. No, similarly, it is really hard to quantify. So I don't know if I can even say, like, I think it will go up, down significantly. I think two comments. One almost contradicts the point that I previously made, where we're sort of actually even the sort of the premise of this question, like how much will it impact kind of institutional investors in particular, as there's sort of other vehicles out there to gain access in Bitcoin. You know, I think there's two things here. So one, the contradiction is that actually, I think a lot of these public miners are actually like widely held by retail. And I actually think like many of them like over 50% owned by retail. And it's probably a lot of retail like speculators that, you know, maybe will stay there, maybe won't. I think one thing that actually could drive more attention to these public miners is that, I mean, I had calls throughout the beginning of the year where, you know, there were a lot of hedge funds, a lot of investors in general that just wanted to understand the space more. And by space, I mean like specifically the mining space, because they were starting to see these returns, starting to see, okay, wow, these public equities outperform Bitcoin sort of during this price run up. I can invest in these. I need to better understand, but hadn't actually allocated capital yet. And I think we're actually still, I mean, a lot of institutions, frankly, are somewhat slow. And so we're even in a period where I think a lot of institutions are still doing, you know, their due diligence, doing their analysis to actually even understand mining economics, understand, you know, which companies they view as relatively like overvalued, relatively undervalued, which could actually drive more capital into those businesses as they start to better understand what's going on. And so, yeah, I mean, it's really hard for me to say, like, when as more products go out there, as it becomes easier and easier to access Bitcoin, like what the impact is going to be on mining companies. I guess I do think it maybe will start to become a little bit more of a transition from, you know, investing in the companies because you really believe in their business, believe in their team, believe in the setup, as opposed to sort of pure, you know, Bitcoin exposure. You probably will see a little bit less of that.
Totally. So while we're on the subject of public markets, I want to ask a question I've been asking almost everyone, I'll say. So we got two headlines to throw up really quickly here. But of course, everyone knows that China banned Bitcoin for like the 35th time this morning. And so actually, can we go to the other one really quick, Damien? We'll go to that one in a second. But I'm wondering about mining companies choosing to go public and where they're choosing to go public. So there was another headline, which I don't have a picture for, but of another mining company planning to looking at, or it's actually Amber Group. Now it's top of my head, not a mining company, but a finance group out of Asia. And it's looking to go public soon, but it's thinking about Hong Kong. It's thinking about the US. It's not quite sure what it's going to do. Of course, securities regulations in the US are a little bit more stringent. So they're worried about that. But at the same time, Hong Kong is facing a ton of pressure from mainland China. So if we have that first image, that'd be awesome, of the China ban But if not, all good. We also saw that FTX chose to move out of Hong Kong and is now going to Bahamas. So my general question is just like, what is the play for these mining companies that might have a lot of market participants in the East Asia region? And will they slowly choose to go to US markets as opposed to Asian markets because of China's more aggressive stance in the region? Maybe that includes Chinese firms themselves, maybe firms that are in that general area. Roshan, I want to throw that question first to you if I can.
Yeah, I mean, I think it makes sense, honestly, like in terms of what you're seeing out of China right now. And, you know, everyone likes to joke that, hey, like, you know, every year since like 2013, there's always a big ban on mining in China or trading or something like that of the sort. And it blows over year over year. And, you know, in many senses, this is like, I see the parallels to that. The only thing that, you know, could be different about it this time is what you've seen with the kind of Chinese government doing with the other sort of public equities that are out there, like specifically with like the Alibaba IPO and other ones where they've, you know, taken a sort of firmer stance there. And you look at like equity valuations in China, I think it's something like over 1.1 trillion has been wiped out in the last 6 months or something very, very significant like that. So there is like an element of the government is kind of taking a much more sort of harmonious, prosperous, national, like kind of bringing things together in a more unified sense. And, you know, if they don't really, you know, like mining, then it the risk reward of staying versus going elsewhere is probably pretty skewed. And I think Brian can probably speak better to the, specifically the hash rate drop off that you saw kind of a couple months ago after there was a big sort of, I think it was in Shenzhen or something like that, a sort of crackdown of sorts on mining. But you know, miners have more incentives than ever to leave. And then, you know, touching on the FTX news, moving out of Hong Kong to the Bahamas, like, you know, SBF is a very forward thinking person. And, you know, I don't think it's any coincidence that he was able to get out of Hong Kong before today, right? It would seem like stranger if it happened like, you know, a week or two from now. But the fact that it was like a couple weeks ago, you know, and it takes a lot of preparation to move an entire exchange out of Hong Kong to a different jurisdiction. And the fact that it's already done getting ahead of this just goes to show you, I think, you know, if one of like the best sort of exchange operators or traders in the world is kind of taking this kind of stance, like, you know, you could see kind of where the trend's going to go. But yeah, I'll give it to Brian.
Yeah, I mean, all I would really add is that it, definitely regulatory considerations are big in evaluating regulatory risks, sort of particularly even where you set up a mining operation is huge. I mean, it's more than just cost of power. And I think while, you know, there's a lot of headlines in the US that kind of like question sometimes stability here, we live in a really stable place with like a very strong legacy financial system, great capital markets, good access to capital, and frankly, a very stable like regulatory system in general, even though there's headlines that just sort of question what's next from sort of various agencies. And so I think there's a lot of appealing reasons to be in North America. And we see a lot of miners coming here, both to sort of like set up their operations as well as to sort of access public markets here.
I kind of want to keep that thought with you, Brian. Like, as we've seen this transition, you know, of miners specifically sort of all over the globe after China's not the most recent crackdown, I guess, two crackdowns ago, hard to keep up sometimes. But there's been conversation with miners of there are in mining communities of like non-domestic miners, more specifically, like mostly formerly Chinese-based miners, having like difficult times adjusting to operating in the US, from like hosting agreements being structured differently and different expectations to power agreements also being structured differently. And there's just like a steep learning curve from how they've always operated and structured things in Chinese mining business basically norms to North American mining norms. Just curious if you could speak to that maybe a little bit from your experience and perspectives, things you've seen. Maybe that's completely false. Like, I've seen small examples of it here and there, but I just want to hand that to you and hear your thoughts on that sort of transition and how like non-US based miners coming to the US have had an easy or difficult time adjusting and setting up shop here.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's a range. I wouldn't say it's, you know, all miners coming from China are facing sort of the same difficulties. I think some of the largest, most sophisticated ones, I think, are, you know, pretty good at it. Maybe they already had connections here. They sort of understand how the markets work, and others struggle with it a little bit more. And I frankly sympathize with them, because I mean, even someone who's been in the mining business in the US for a while, it's still tough to like I still have to rely on lawyers a lot of the time. It's still tough to understand like certain like power agreements, certain regulations that exist. And so, yeah, there's definitely challenges there. But I mean, one thing in particular too is just even like how you set up a certain facility in the US. You obviously, there's sort of local, regional guidelines, national guidelines, a completely different set of safety standards. Right. So if you were to tour, say, you know, some type of hosting facility, a mining operation in China, you not all the time, but like you could see, you know, wires all over the place, things that would clearly be seen as sort of just clear risks, I would say. But what they achieve then is lower operating costs, lower capital costs to set up that operation in the first place, versus now probably being hit with, you know, fees for lawyers, higher CapEx costs in the US. And so that's a big challenge. I think the other thing too is what we're just seeing globally in terms of supply chains, shipping, things like that. I mean, it's slow to set up. And frankly, a lot of what miners need, not even just hardware, which is obviously well documented that it's coming from China or Southeast Asia, and you have to ship that to the US, but also just other sort of like electrical infrastructure, electrical pieces that you need to ship in from now across the globe, where a lot of Chinese miners probably, you know, could ship in much more locally, access those materials more locally previously. But now if they're setting up an operation here, it's just a much higher cost even in general.
Gotcha. Yeah, no, that makes perfect sense. I appreciate that color. We've had, you know, probably similar conversations, similar experiences, and across the board, you know, everyone coming to the U.S. that was previously mining outside the U.S. isn't having like a nightmare. But there are, and in some ways it's cool, some ways it's a little bit of a headache, but almost every mining jurisdiction operates differently, just for like basic political and regulatory reasons, but also for different like mining, more niche cultural norms that have sort of evolved. It's interesting to observe. So there's a couple things. We're creeping up towards the top of the hour here, kind of on time, but I kind of want to hit on two particular topics. I want to get to hash rate derivatives in a minute, but I have one more sort of fully speculative question to throw at you guys. I know Will will love it because he's our resident Ether fanboy. But you know, we see a lot of some miners making what you might describe as like outsized bets that Ethereum's switch to proof of stake will continue to be delayed. They're accumulating hardware and financing in other ways, their Ether mining operations. I don't want to talk shit on any of that, but I kind of want to know your opinion, like on the bet that they're placing, basically. Like, do you think, you know, miners placing bets that what has been regularly delayed ever since like 2016, 2017 will continue to be delayed, or, you know, whether we're sort of coming up to the end of the clock here and the switch will happen. They'll either have to switch to ETC or some other proof of work coin, who knows. That whole debacle. Curious to know both of your opinions on that. Roshan, I'll hand it to you first. I don't know if you have any particular insights on, you know, the whole ETH transition thing, but then Brian also want to know your opinion on ETH miners.
Yeah, for sure. And in terms of, yeah, like I don't know necessarily like kind of what you could change to if like ETH were to go full proof of stake with the same mining hardware. Like that's less of my expertise. I would hope though, like if the miners that, or imagine that if they, you know, they would have some sort of backup plan in the case that Ethereum went fully proof of stake, because I'm of the opinion, and it's really hard to predict really, of course, with Ethereum development cycles and how fast things are going. And now like, you know, layer twos are the real like talk of scaling, and like it seems like that's like patching the solution for a minute here. I do think the merge has to happen soon. Otherwise, it's like not soon, let's say like Q2 of next year or Q1 of next year, around that time, just because like given how much you know, buildup is going into this and how much of a shift it is, like the merge is a significant sort of binary event that, yes, it's been delayed, and I probably sound like this might not age so well, being like, oh, Q1, Q2 of next year. But I do think it's going to come eventually. So, you know, maybe some of the miners are doing something where, like, you know, they're betting that they can like earn a lot more into that merge, because, and I don't know necessarily how it's going right now with like the whole NFT craze and like some of the gas fee wars you see right now. Like yesterday around noon, like because of some NFT drop, like Gwei was at like 10,000. So people think like maybe the miners are speculating that there is going to be a fervor of transaction activity in the next 6 months. So they're betting on like the equipment that they're pulling in might not necessarily be because like they think the merge is going to be delayed, but maybe they're actually going to be able to extract a ton out of Ethereum, because what people are paying Ethereum miners right now is frankly very high. I feel like, you know, just like the Gwei prices you see. So, you know, there could be more to their purchase orders and their setups rather than just the merge. And I do think that the merge should happen in Q1 or Q2.
Yeah, we'll see if it ends up happening. We had some GPU miners on stream, which of course they don't want the switch to happen, and they are pretty bearish against it actually happening. And you talk to some developers and they have the shields on now. They don't even pay attention to anyone outside. They're just like so focused on their goal. So like two very distinct camps going on right now.
Yeah. Hopefully it doesn't end in any sort of splits or anything like that. That's not fun. Yeah.
I don't know. Messy is always the most fun. So
that's true. Side.
Brian, I want to ask you from like a financial angle. I don't know if Galaxy assists in any lending apps for Ethereum miners at all. We know that Hut 8 just took out a pretty sizable position in a GPU facility up in Canada. Just like speculating here, would Galaxy be interested in helping out Ethereum miners into this year, knowing that a lot of their equipment could be bunk pretty shortly?
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't have too much insight here. And part of it is that I'm just frankly less familiar with sort of the current state of the economics for ETH mining than Bitcoin mining. And in particular, I'm curious, I just don't know off the top of my head what sort of the payback period is expected for some of these GPU miners, because I think that would be sort of the critical thing to understand is sort of, you know, if there's a delay sort of beyond, like if we hit Q1, we hit Q2, if there's then a further delay, I assume at that point you've probably already paid back these GPUs, in which case, okay, maybe then it's just sort of, okay, what's the risk that you're taking here? What's the potential payback? And it seems like there's two options basically, is that everything goes on schedule that impacts miners, ETH miners sort of negatively, but they've hopefully done sort of a decent calculation of that risk. And what they're sort of betting on is that, you know, if there's any sort of delay, that there's a lot of miners out there that chose not to take that risk, and then they sort of get an outsized reward there. And so I can't say that like we necessarily would or wouldn't work with any ETH miners. I think it's just evaluating sort of, okay, what's the payback period on these machines? And then sort of what probability do we associate with sort of like these two separate outcomes, and what's sort of the payoff in each case?
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. I think, and Will probably has much more insight into this than I do. I sort of have also similar blinders on, just focus on Bitcoin mining. But the general consensus I've gotten from like ETH miners is, you know, Ethereum Classic will probably have everything to gain, at least in terms of gaining hash rate and network security from miners shifting whenever it happens. Roshan, we won't hold you to any prediction for Q1, Q2 of the transition happening. I think Will kind of agrees with that timeline probably also, but I won't offer any guess. I have no idea. And I also, you know, don't really care at the end of the day. Just kidding. I care a little bit, but not too much. Okay. So the last thing I want to talk about, and I'm brutalizing the question by only giving us a few minutes to talk about it, but we can't have a discussion about like financial products for miners without talking about mining related derivatives products. And, you know, we've seen to date these sorts of products go through a couple different iterations, from, you know, just sort of raw hash rate driven futures products to like actual hash rate, hash power backed tokens that a bunch of different companies are launching and sometimes pausing and then relaunching. We won't name names, but I'm curious to know your guys' opinions on just sort of the like on-chain related derivatives products, hash rate related derivatives products, all of this stuff, if they'll ever sort of catch on and gain traction. And if you think they will, like when, and maybe even like what form they'll take when they're actually of like some large scale productive use to miners who they're obviously targeting. Brian, I know you've done a lot of work on this stuff, so I want to hand it to you first, and then Roshan, if you have thoughts on it too.
Sure. Yeah. I guess I'll start with hash rate derivatives, because I just find it as somewhat of an interesting topic. And it's funny thinking back to like 2020, like particularly the summer of 2020, you literally couldn't go on any type of mining podcast without half of it basically being dedicated to a talk about like hash rate derivatives. And I think that now there's just been less discussion on them lately. And part of it goes back to what I was talking about earlier, where there's just honestly less of a need to hedge against sort of like moves up in hash rate, because hash rate is so much lower than I think a lot of miners expected it to sort of be by this quarter in 2021, just due to the Chinese mining ban. And I think the desire to sort of hedge against unexpected moves upward in hash rate will increase, yeah, as margins go down. I think the other thing as well is that a lot of the early products that were rolled out there, whether you're sort of like betting on difficulty, maybe engaging in some sort of difficulty swap, they really weren't sort of perfect products in the first place. And again, I guess maybe to even just take a step back and talk about sort of how hash rate impacts mining economics and why it could be important to hedge is that miners are sort of inherently short hash rate, where when hash rate goes up, your Bitcoin denominated revenue goes down. So basically the idea would be that a miner would theoretically go long hash rate in order to then like protect themselves against an even higher move up in hash rate than they had expected, cutting further into their Bitcoin denominated revenue. But the problem is that a lot of these early products that existed, particularly on sort of some exchanges out there, you couldn't actually sort of hedge your operation through just that one vehicle, because on sort of like the losing side, so let's say you're a miner and go long hash rate and then hash rate actually drops. Typically when hash rate drops, you can sort of have like a one-time event like the Chinese mining ban, but more frequently it's due to say a price drop. So like a good example is even the crash in March 2020 that occurred across, you know, all markets, hit equities hard as well, where we had a huge price crash, right? And then it was one of the largest difficulty drops of all time. And what would have happened basically to a miner in that situation is if they sort of had this strategy to consistently go long hash rate to hedge their operation, they would have lost big on that trade, right? Because hash rate drops significantly. And the idea is normally, okay, your hash rate drops, you lose on that trade, but you make up for it because now you have higher Bitcoin denominated revenue. And so the hope is that that basically sort of cancels out. So higher Bitcoin denominated revenue, lose on that trade, and you're sort of even. But the reality is that what happens is now the Bitcoin that you're mining, like, yeah, you have more Bitcoin, but it's literally like 50% of the price of what it was like 2 days earlier when we saw a crash from like $8,000, $9,000 to like below $5,000. And so you basically lost big on that trade. And then the Bitcoin that you're now earning is down a lot as well. And so you sort of needed to engage in this trade that was like long hash rate, short Bitcoin, kind of to like actually fully hedge like what you're trying to do, which I think a lot of miners I even talked about, like we're still educating them on fairly basic kind of hedging strategies in some cases. Like there's just not a desire for miners to like engage in that kind of like challenging type of trade. And so I think part of where this is going is, one, as margins collapse and we'd see sort of an unexpected move in hash rate would actually make miners unprofitable, I think there will be a greater desire to hedge. But I think where you're going, and to get to that part of your question, I kind of hope to see hash rate actually be more of, you know, a tradable, fungible, ideally, asset, and turn into more of an asset class with exchanges out there. Because once you can start really trading hash rate and buying it in sort of set types of contracts, I think it opens up a lot of flexibility to sort of build derivatives around that. And then you don't have to, you know, you can just have sort of a clean sale of hash rate if that's what you want to do, which I think is a lot easier for a lot of miners to even conceptualize.
Yeah, I agree with all of that. And I know Krim, who's also on your team, and the guys at Luxor are all super bullish on, you know, the evolution of like a hash rate market, as treating hash rate as the commodity it is, in addition to, you know, the other crypto assets and the established markets that they have. That future will be very exciting for miners. Roshan, same question to you. Like, I'm not sure on a day-to-day basis in terms of trading how much you interact with like hash rate derivatives and other of these sorts of products, but very curious to hear your thoughts on like their status now and sort of their potential to evolve in the future.
Yeah. And I think, you know, Brian touched on something that I'll get to at the end of my comment here, which makes a lot of sense in what I'm about to say. I'll, you know, take this more from an angle of like constructing a viable derivatives product and a financial product around, you know, what a good derivative is. So like, you know, you take something like a Bitcoin future or derivatives on spot Bitcoin, you know, a lot of people want to buy and sell spot at the same time. So a derivatives market will naturally have like market makers and two-way flow that's like crossing and taking, and kind of there will be good liquidity there. Similar to like a prediction market where you're betting on an outcome of like a boxing fight or a sports game, you know, those markets will have two-way flow. When you're talking about a hash rate derivatives market, who are going to be the participants generally that are going to be engaging in this market. It's miners. They all have the same exact operation or similar operation and same cash flows and same sides. So the market is going to be very skewed on liquidity. Everyone's going to want to do one thing versus the other. So by just nature of the structure of that, it's hard to create a viable derivatives market off the bat without any sort of underlying two-way flow. But then what Brian touched on was more tokenizing hash rate and creating a spot product first, which people can own that and sell that. Once you have something like that, granted that still might have a lot of one-way flow, but at least it's a spot product, which people will own. They'll have to sell it at some point. And there could be like AMMs where people can buy it. Then it's more viable to create a derivatives product around it because you have that two-way flow. So, you know, I'm not like a huge pro, like a professional in like knowing where to long hash rate or short at hash rate. I have no idea, but I do know with how you kind of like create financial products, and you're going to need a two-sided market in order for that to happen.
Awesome. Brian, Roshan, I want to thank you guys so much for jumping on the stream to talk about Bitcoin mining finances with us. I think it's a really underexplored topic, and hopefully we can return to it in the next few months, maybe even with you two back on the stream and see how the industry has changed. I want to thank everyone who's in our comments section. Thanks for jumping in, watching the live stream. Anyone listening on the podcast, also thanks for listening. Be sure to like and subscribe to our channel. We do this twice weekly, and we have two awesome streams lined up for next week on Wednesdays and Fridays. Also want to thank Zach. Thanks for jumping on the show.
Yeah. Again, thanks, Brian and Risha. And this has been a super fun conversation. Love having you guys on. Love the work you do in the Bitcoin space, finance and general finance and like mining finance, both. For everyone watching, they're both on Twitter. We get more shit posts out of Rishon than Brian, but you know, they're both definitely worth follows. Both very, very smart and insightful people. That's all from us for today. Enjoy your weekend. Brian and Rishon, thank you both for coming on the show. Will, as always, thank you. That's a wrap.